Time for us to begin this evening. If you will go ahead and get your Bibles out, turn to Leviticus chapter 10. We're going to be looking at that. Before we get into our class, though, tonight, would you please bow with me in prayer? Heavenly Father, we thank you for this privilege to approach your throne. We hope that as we do so, our hearts are clear and focused on serving you. Help us as we not only approach you tonight, but in each step we take to give you glory and honor and give you the space that is due to your holiness. Help us to be good servants. Help us to be encouragers. Help us to see heaven in the midst of a very broken and wearisome journey. Please forgive us of our sins, and we ask this prayer in the name of your Son. Amen. All right, we've got the 10th chapter of Leviticus. I've got a whole lot of stuff on my plate that I hope that we can serve up for tonight's Bible study, but we'll see if we can get to all of it, because there is an absolute feast of information in just this one chapter. We introduced it on Sunday, and again, that's Leviticus chapter 10. We're started with the first half of the story of Nadab and Abihu. We talked about its immediate implications. We talked about the attitude that Aaron had to work through, and now there are some secondary matters that are the consequence of this event that will help us see to some primary attitude aspects in our approach to God. Because there is, as I've already mentioned, a whole lot that goes on here. Like I mentioned on Sunday, I'll mention again, pretty much every preacher I know and pretty much every good Bible student I know knows this Bible study and Bible story and uses this Bible story to illustrate appropriate worship to God and the consequences of not rising to God's standard. A couple of things that are of value for us is to take that framework and pay attention to the motives and the answers that God gives when His standard was broken. Proximity-wise, remind yourself that this event essentially follows immediately after Israel seeing, recognizing and acknowledging the presence of God in their midst. So it's God was right there as He could be for Israel, and then this. A couple of y'all and I talked about another key event that takes place, which has to do with the connected details of a comment that God, through Moses, makes back in regards to the use of wine and strong drink. Those are two related Hebrew words. The word for wine there is yayin. That generally refers to a fermented fruit, almost exclusively in the Old Testament to grape. So wine in the typical English sense, such as yayin, if you want to know the Hebrew, if you're really interested. And to help understand this, one thing I want to point out is the yayin, or the wine of the Old Testament, is not typically what Americans buy at the store. Americans buy at a store a wine that's been fortified. We have a culture that says we want more alcohol in our wine. So almost all table wines in the U.S. are effectively a fortified or a slightly higher level of alcohol per water ratio than this. Strong drink, on the other hand, is the next phase up. It's equivalent of a hard liquor. Not exactly, but you can think about it in that term. You're trying to understand, what is this? How is it different than wine, alcoholic wine, versus grape juice, which they also had, by the way. Tirosh, which is about as fresh as you can get. That's basically, I took the grape and I squeezed it into my mouth as a way to think about it. So they have that too. So it's not that they didn't have grape juice. They didn't have these things. It's just to give you a framework to understand what are they talking about. So this wine is definitely alcoholic wine. And this strong drink is definitely alcoholic beverages of a higher level. So just keep that in mind as to kind of get what we're talking about for the details. One more thing that is important to catch that we talked about on Sunday before we get to this next section is more about the attitude of Aaron. He has matured significantly since the golden calf incident to the point that from this point forward, you don't really see him blaming God for the behavior of his sons, blaming anyone else in that sense. And when he holds his peace, it really needs to be something that we say is a testament to his character because of the timing. Holy presence of God, they misbehaved spiritually to a deep level. As a parent, I can tell you that I've seen my kids do that. I tell everybody this is the way to do it, family-wise, group-wise, and my kid is the one who doesn't do it the right way. Have you ever been there? Shake and nod. That's all, every parent, everywhere, every day. The stakes are much higher here. But Aaron's character helps him kind of moderate back, and Moses' admonition helps him pull back. So just remember that as you're looking forward. We talked also about the inclusion of Aaron's uncle's sons, and now they carry the bodies of Nadab and Abihu out of the tabernacle proper to the edges of the camp as a great reminder fashion for Israel. That certainly would be a sobering moment, kind of like Ananias and Sapphira. Fear. Oh, wait a minute. God was there. They immediately did that. Whoa, the God we serve is serious business. So there's a good connection there. Let's hone in now on that the section I kind of mentioned a couple of different ways. And this is verses 8 through 10. Steve, can you read that for us? Leviticus chapter 10, verses 8 through 11. All right, so quick connection. Aaron's instruction comes from where? They come from his own desires, good reasoning, good sense, the Lord. And it was very specific. You shall not. In other words, don't do this. And it's yayin, the grape juice, and shikar, which is typically a fermented beverage made from honey, apples, pomegranates. You'll notice that the sugar level is much higher in those beverages, so it's going to potentially ferment quicker. That's really what the difference is in the mechanical side of it. The details of that are outside of my realm of experience, but that's what I read. So again, if you want chemical information, you go to Matthew Brett. He's the expert with that stuff. He'll correct any details you might want to have. But here's the thing. Catch what's some of the reasons why and what's going on here. This prohibition is given by God to them. Did you notice some reasons why they needed to do this? What was so important? Okay, first thing. In their role, and that's the second one, first thing, holiness. If these priests made it a practice to drink some level of alcoholic wine or some level, and by some level I mean any amount, from one drop to all of it they could find, because he said don't do it at all, they stopped being holy in their roles. Secondly, so holiness is a concern. Teaching. You ever interacted with a drunk person? And by drunk, I mean any level of alcohol in their body. Yeah, I have too. Do they necessarily make it easy for you to have a good conversation, or does it kind of go downhill? Yeah, and it doesn't really matter how much. A little bit? Is there anything in the Proverbs that talks about a little bit of wine as a warning side? Not the songs of joy that sometimes come up. I'm going on the other end that matches this picture here of God saying no. Oh, yeah. It looks all smooth in the cup, doesn't it? Oh, and then at the last, what does it do? Yeah, a poisonous critter. It bites you. It comes back and it gets you. Every single time. I spent a lot of time when I was younger around people who had drinking problems because of my family and in the work that I did before I was preaching. You know, you work as a bouncer long enough, you deal with people who are drunk. And you work as a musician long enough, you're working around drunk people. That's just how it is. And just a little bit, and it changes. Now, if their role is to specifically and accurately teach God's Word, because they're teachers, because priests were not just holy servants, they're educators too. Is being a little bit drunk, just a little bit, going to have an impact on their capacity to do that? And I don't even have to know how that will play out on the practical level, because on the specific level, God said, this is why. This is why from an instructor's level. You don't do that. We do that in life, don't we? Have you ever had to take medication for recovery and it says not to do certain things? What are some of the things that you're not supposed to do when you're taking a pain reliever of a significant amount? You know, doctor supplied, a little bit for your stomach.
Drive, operate
machinery. Should you be teaching people to do things or you just make a logical connection? Well, no. Because if you can't drive straight, you can't operate straight, I guarantee you, you're not talking straight either. And sometimes you don't even remember what you did. Yeah. Yeah. You know, they have a zero tolerance for a lot of things. Physical conditions, physical impairments, all kinds of stuff across the board. I don't even know the list. I know Brian knows some of the list, if not all the list, and it's extensive. And we want them that way. And we want them clear-headed. We want them capable and able. So, here's a connection that kind of ties that reminder. In verse 10, when it began, is that terminology that makes us able to say, yes, these two ideas are deeply linked. It says, verse 10 in the ESV, you are to distinguish between the things that are holy and common and between unclean and clean, and you are to teach. And so you have that statute saying this because you are. I mean, this because you have to be. So make a quick application. When you're looking at just this section of the text and you haven't any other of the Bible under consideration, and then all of a sudden you're talking to Christians, would you come back and say to Christians today, you know, I think it'd be a great idea if we drank a little. Is there any good, if you're just looking at this general principle, that would be a good thing to say? No. Is there some caveats in the New Testament about drinking? I just mentioned one, my big belly, suffering, trying to make it smaller, so it's growling at me. A little wine for your stomach. And Paul says very specifically, change your practice. Don't do what you're doing. Do this because you need to for your health. Sometimes that's a picture we look at. But as a general rule, there's no good that comes from it. And here's the great mental connectors. I don't even have to go into the great details of Proverbs, we've already mentioned Peter's exposition of the stages of drinking from a little sip to a full-on drunken craziness. If we're priests, and we are, and we're supposed to teach, and we do, that it's wise to make sure that we are sober. Oh, wait a minute, didn't someone tell Christians to be sober? We're sober-minded, right? So it's just a good reminder in the general sense to drive down to here it is in the Scriptures, one of the positive reasons to stay away from something. You know, you don't have to go to great lengths to explain all the mechanics of the way in which alcohol has changed over the years, and it has, and we can. You don't have to go into the great extensions of first century wine versus 21st century wine. There's a difference there and all that. Here it is, just in a very simple sense. God's holy presence is there. Their choice to engage in unholy behavior. And then God says no. And Bobby brought something up after class, which is also part of our thing for tonight. You ever wonder why Nadab and Abihu are all of a sudden kind of stupid? I wonder that about myself sometimes. And Nadab and Abihu too. You notice the connection of when? Oh, this instruction came right after that. Yeah. Yeah. Over the years in my life, knowing folks who did stupid things in high school and in college, with regularity, alcohol was involved when the stupidity rose to trouble. Every time. If it wasn't alcohol, it was a more significant mind-altering drug. I mean, just 100% of the time. With young people, boom, every time. Your influence precedes your speech. And while we never know exactly who's looking at us and watching us, just remember that basic truth. Your influence exceeds, your example exceeds, precedes things you say. And they'll see that. And they'll know that. Particularly the most vulnerable people. The ones who are struggling spiritually, the ones who are needing the most personal level of help, they see that. And yes, if they see someone who's a glutton, a drunkard, a thief, they're not going to listen to you talk about the Bible. They're going to look for someone who isn't a drunkard, a glutton, a thief, a murderer, etc. And they're going to look for someone who's got some closeness to God in their actions. Tim, was that your hand raising? And I'm not going to say in all the times I've been asked those questions about drinking that the questions have been, why can't I drink, or what's wrong with me having some alcohol, and sometimes they are. And I'll tell you, in those cases, it's really someone who already has decided they want to drink. They want to run with the world around them, and they're looking for the removal of the last obstacles in their way. Because their heart's already changed. They've already decided that's what they're going to do. It's just waiting for the dam to break and the waters to rush forth. The right questions to ask are in a different category. What behaviors, attitudes, or actions will draw me closer to God? What choices can I make are going to make a better relationship between me and my brethren? Those are better questions. But those are more uncomfortable if we've already made a choice that says, I want to do this. Or, I want you to stop doing that. And now that might be, stop telling me to stop doing this. You know, leave me alone. In all of this, keep in mind those two principles, if we could reframe it that way. What actions, attitudes, or behaviors help me better explain or show God's holiness? Because that goes right back to our text. Not drinking, that makes it better. And I say not drinking in this very immediate context. Yayin and shekar, the strong drink, the wine. I'll definitely better in my holiness and my ability to teach. That's different than saying, well, why can't I? It's saying, I will be better then because God said. They're both correct answers and they're both viable questions. Well, you can't because God said all these things, and you shouldn't because God said all these things. They're on different ends of the coin. But we're trying to pick the better end of the coin to be on, the edge of the conversation, the one that brings us close to God, the one that makes us more spiritually focused in our process and our decisions. The next section of this text, it moves forward off of that, and there's a second sense of offerings. I always have to remind myself as we're going from chapter 8 to chapter 10 that this is a very short period of time. Sometimes these chapters cover large chunks of recorded history. But in a very short period, we have the first congregational worship of Israel. It's like you could think about it as the first preaching of the gospel on Pentecost. The first time the church meshed together after the resurrection of Christ, to memorialize His death, burial, and resurrection. A lot of firsts going on. But they also had this spear right in the joyful moment. And that spear landed right at the feet of Aaron. Just crushingly. And yet, they move forward. Aaron moves forward. Moses moves forward. Israel moves forward. They acknowledge these steps that they need to take to improve their perspective of holiness and improve their understanding of what God needs them to do. And further, you can see a little bit of the shift there. Let's go ahead and read verses 16 through 20 to kind of jump the last section together. Roy, could you read that for us? I'm going down the middle of the aisle tonight, apparently. I didn't plan to do that, but that's what I've done. Think about that private conversation that's basically being recorded. It's a little window into things. And Aaron's last comment, if I had eaten, would the Lord have approved? Where do you think his heart was? We know that he closed his mouth and he held his pace and he held his peace. But you ever see someone who is obviously broken on the inside, but they put the stiff upper lip out when they go about their business? Do you think any of them really want to be offering sacrifices? They want to be mourning. And Moses' expectation was, let Israel mourn. You go and serve. It seems hard-hearted, doesn't it, on one level? Like, well, don't they get to mourn? Sometimes we don't get to. Because there's things more important than me. You know, we just kind of connect it to the idea of sacrifice and service versus self-pleasing. On this individual level, we all want, I want Aaron to have a chance to mourn. He needs that chance to go through. But who's the high priest? Can anyone else do that job? No. Sometimes that's how it is. Sometimes it's life. In your household, you all have defined roles. And if they're not being filled, do things run well? Even when I was living with roommates, we broke stuff down. You had your chore list, and you had my chores, their chores. We had our milk purchase list. That's the only thing we shared in common was milk. So you had each week someone was responsible for making sure we had milk in the house. It's a big responsibility when you have four growing, young men. Large quantities of milk necessary in our home. Someone doesn't do their job. Little things go, and then it goes downhill. Well, in this case, this had to go forward. But on the emotional level, you can see a conflict. You ever felt like that in the worship side where you know you need to be somewhere, but your heart needs you to be somewhere else? Yeah. Lots of times in funerals. Sometimes doing evangelistic work overseas. I'm at the right place doing the right thing at the right time for the right reasons, and I'd rather be home. Because my kid just did, or I didn't get to see. Those are real experiences. I'm sure you all have that too. Seeing this about Moses and Aaron in their relationship and seeing this family that is in the closest compartments of service to God go through very normal, emotional, family-based events is a little bit different than the brothers that make up the tribes. How do their family events go? They're more like the backseat of a station wagon on a road trip. Joseph's telling us again that we're going to all bow down to him. He says we're corn stalks. That's their conversations when they're younger. So we're sticking him in the back of the station wagon. We're throwing all the stuff on him. We're throwing him into the pit. That's their behavior. And then they get back, and they get back, and they get back, and it goes worse, and they finally reconcile. And even that is a bit of an awkward reconciliation because there's still fear. There's a little bit more closeness here between these two grown men. And there's also a little bit of deference. Moses is still Moses. And Aaron is still Aaron, the high priest. And they've got to work through these things. On the surface level, you look at it and go, well, certainly. Let the dead bury the dead. Okay, now it's your mom's funeral. It's not just a fake excuse anymore. Because I'm quite certain that some of the people in those illustrations that Jesus were trying to reach were making things up as excuses not to go. They weren't actually going to go to do the other thing either. They just said, well, this is a polite way for me to say I don't want to go. But the principle's still true. It's still true that laying them out on the table, walking with Jesus is more important than these earthly matters. Walking with the literal Son of God is always more precious, more valuable, more essential. Any quick questions or comments here in chapter 10? We're going to actually spend a little bit of time by intention summarizing 8, 9, and 10 as an ensemble if we can get through it. That's also part of the plan. JW? Okay, sure. Couple things. Unlike our culture, the first century culture is a little bit different in the way that its beverages are acquired. The choices are a lot slimmer in the first century. You have water, but it's going to be contaminated. It's going to have diseases in it, and it's going to make people sick unless it comes from a well. Remember why a lot of times there's fighting in the Old Testament? Over drinking water. So fresh water that we like and that can come out of our tap, that's a rarity. In order to combat that, a lot of the individuals would do what's called cutting wine with water. And there's rules that they had established. What that means is they take some variation of stored water or stored wine that's in a wine skin, and by a ratio, they put a little bit of the wine and a whole lot of water. And what does alcohol do to the germs that's in there? Kills it. And so there's a whole category of them. All right? Well, once you do that, from the outside looking at it, is there any way to tell how much alcohol is in it? Not really. That's one aspect of what's going on in the first century by saying not given to much wine. Another aspect of that is to remember that some of these phrases that are translated for us by literal words are missing out on the feeling of the phrase or term. If I say to you, I'm going to see if this commercial reference will work, where's the beef? You guys remember a commercial with that phrase? I guarantee you, if you ask the kids in our Bible classes, my kids might get it because I've said it. And I say might. But if you ask them the question, where's the beef? They're going to be like, what are you talking about? You know, they don't know what the reference is. And so, not given to much wine, as it's translated for us in English, is a phrase or an idiom that's not about the literal idea that it's okay to have a little, but deacons can't have much at all. It's the same phrase of consideration or concern that would say don't do it at all, in essence, but also be careful about your example. You don't need to be seen as one who is around those who are drinkers. And so the idiom or phrase there includes don't, but it's also reputational. But make sure your reputation is of such that no one would even think that you were, because it matches the other overall look of those things. Now, we can go into more detail of that, too, from the linguistic side. But on that particular qualification and that particular criteria, you're looking at one that says your behavior and your relationships and your actions should never give someone the idea that you're a drinker. And that was something that would be a risk for someone in the first century. And, again, drinking cut wine, and I'll use that very term specifically, was pretty common. That's how they got to make sure they didn't get sick from drinking water. But that wine was not anywhere near the alcohol level of even Yayin. Yayin, let's just say, is at level 10. Cut wine is at level 1/2. The wines that are available in the store that people buy are level 20 and 30. Like as a chart, rather than use the percentile, percent per alcohol, and all that stuff. Tim? Yeah. Right. And that reminds me of two quick things. Yes, you could get drunk conceivably off the cut wine, but what Tim's pointing out is you basically have to chug it at a rapid rate all day long unless you went to the strong drink or the straight yayin, but that makes you lazy. And that's the other aspect of this phrase of not being given too much wine. That's a lazy person. That's kind of contrasting what the deacon's supposed to be. Industrious, stable, good stewards, sober-minded in the broad sense. Well, someone who's given too much wine, the exact opposite. They're hanging out at Hall's Grocery on Fisher all day long. I've been told that's a spot. All the high school kids get warned not to do that, so I'm assuming that's a spot. But that's the essence. You're hanging around a bar. You're hanging around a place where it would go down and where they would do that. Does that help, JW? Is that what's, more of what you're looking for? I can give you more. Here's something to think about, too. We look at some of these technicalities, and this is a technicality in the sense that God had already given a broad base of instruction in regards to sobriety in the Christian. And by sobriety, I'm talking about attitude and the choices that are the consequence of your attitude. Sober-minded. And choices that keep you sober-minded. We already know they talked to Timothy in regards to his medical needs. No longer drink water alone, but take a little for your stomach's sake. In essence, go back to drinking some cup wine or whatever the level is that would be included in that idea. We already know that's on the table. So when he brings this up here, it's more than just making sure that the guy doesn't drink wine. There's got to be more to the idea. Because that would already be a general expectation from sober-minded people. So there's more to that picture. And that's why I'm emphasizing this attitude shift. Because if this is the case, then here's the illogical answer to that. If only deacons can be given to not much wine, that means everyone else can have as much wine as they want. Is that true? Is there anything in the Bible that says don't do that? For the appearance of evil? What did Peter say in regards to drinking in very specific terms? Well, he talked about onuphlegia. He talked about a couple other Greek words. So I'll use English words. A drinking bout, a drinking party, a sipping party. What was that? Yeah, that was how we were. That's how we used to be. And by the way, potos, which is the one that's a sipping, that's the little, doesn't matter where you're at, just have a little. You might call that, polite social drinking. Just a little drip. All the way to the most worst examples of it, which is the reveling, the drunken parties, the rowdy parties where they're tearing down the walls. They're all kind of encompassed in that large section. So we already know that's the case. That's already off the table. So whatever is involved in this deacon, it's in the thin margin between a little for your stomach, certainly not what Peter was talking about, and absolutely none at all. Because that's the only other end. Like, you can't get any lower than that amount of drinking alcohol is none at all. And so you see him pushing that way. One more thing to think about. Someone who is an addict, is it a constant struggle for them to stay clean, especially right afterwards? That's a shake and nod moment. Do you think that'd be important for someone who is serving as a deacon to have not had the history of struggling with addiction? I think it might be important in figuring those things out and have them had time to mature past those things. Yeah, you can get over it. You can mature to a point where it's not the issue that it once was. But that animal is always going to be gnawing at your heels. So there's a bigger picture to that phrase and its use there than just the technicalities of the exact meaning of the word as it's translated. Michael? Yeah. And if you want to highlight that you will not die thing, think about everyone that you know that died early in life. Exclude all the ones who had health problems, except for the ones whose health problems were related to their drinking. I'll tell you that at least in my memory, every one of them involved some level of alcohol use on their part or the person's part who caused their death. You talk about living long on the earth? Stop drinking. And it's not really a complicated thing. Addiction's hard to get over, though. And so those are some of the things connecting to the holiness of God and connecting to a desire to be more like God and have that perspective and to understand that, yeah, He cares about those things. Even though the world doesn't. The world certainly does not care about whether you drink or not, as long as you don't do it on their job. Some jobs, at least. All right, chapters 8, 9, and 10 as an ensemble. Maybe we can get it in a minute and a half. Maybe we won't. We'll see. Doubtful. Couple of things that are really important, and we'll carry off the rest of them till the beginning of next Bible class. Chapters 8, 9, and 10, as an overarching fact, are about the presence of God right there with Israel. If nothing else, that's the high point. God's glory being in their midst. The preparation for it, the acceptable and true sacrifice given in advance of it, and God's response. Yes, there was failure, and yes, there was struggle, but God still wanted him around. I want to highlight one thing. It's 7:42, so we got 1 minute. Notice this. After the rebellion of two of Aaron's sons, God speaks to Aaron. Yes, he gives them instruction, but he doesn't leave them alone. People you don't care about, those are the ones you don't talk to. People you care about, even if you're upset with them or they're upset with you, keep trying to talk to them. No doubt that God was heartbroken. He gave practical instruction that would prevent it from happening again. And they accepted it. They swallowed it down as heavy and as hard as it was. All right, we'll get the rest of what I've got there for the chapters together perhaps Sunday morning. Thanks, everybody. I really appreciate your participation and your questions. Like I said, there's a lot going on in that 10th chapter.